Around the turn of the 20th century, it was a given that every town in Iowa had to have a post office. But if a town really wanted to get on the map, it also needed an opera house. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Opera houses were showpieces and symbols of civic pride. Many Iowa opera houses have fallen into disrepair or been destroyed, but more and more towns are restoring their opera houses. And Sam Knutson, a singer-songwriter from Iowa City, has made it his goal to bring live music back to these beautiful buildings. I'll talk with him about his Iowa Opera House project, and we'll explore the history of Iowa opera houses. Join our conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When a small town in Iowa built an opera house, it showed everyone that the community had really arrived. This hour, we're going to talk about the history of opera houses in Iowa and the movement to restore these beautiful old buildings. We'll talk specifically about the opera houses in Cedar Falls, Sioux City, Pella, and Greenfield. We also want to hear about the opera house in your town. We're going to have a lot of different guests this hour, so why don't you send us an email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, so we can work your comments into the conversation. Again, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. You can also leave a post on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. We're going to start the hour with a man who's trying to bring live music back to the opera houses of Iowa. Sam Knutson is a singer-songwriter from Iowa City and the originator of the Iowa Opera House Project. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. Where did this idea come from? What made you think we need to be performing in these venues?
Well, a little more than a year ago, a friend of mine took me to the Opera House in Watchier, Iowa, which has been continuously operating since the 1890s. It burned and was rebuilt in 1895. And it was to see a country band. It was sort of an old country band. And I just sort of wondered, how do bands get into places like this? How is this done? Everybody in the band was like 85 years old. I ended up talking to the person who was running sound for the show. She was in her late 70s, and her boyfriend was the lead guitar player in the band. He was in his mid 80s. I was like, "Wow, how does this happen?" And they're like, "Well, we're the house band. We've been doing this forever." I'm like, "Well, that's not the answer I want to hear." So I ended up talking to most of the other people who worked in the theater, and found out that the people who ran the hardware store were sort of in charge of keeping the place up, and was told, "Well, we got kind of a good show going on here, but we don't have anything going on compared to what they have in Pella." I'm like, "Pella?" This was before, you know, the candidates had stopped there, and I didn't really have any idea that there was an opera house there or that there were any more opera houses than that one, which I had driven by before. And so I called Pella, and they said, "Well, yeah, we got an opera house here, but have you read the book?" And I'm like, the book? No, I haven't read the book. And there was a book published in 1994 called Opera Houses of Iowa.
Right, and we'll be talking with the authors of that book in just a few
minutes.
Oh, you're
kidding me. Yeah. I would love to meet them. That's fantastic. Are they in the building?
No, they'll be on the phone.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, maybe I'll call in. So that was the beginning of a conversation that was in the back section of the Opera Houses of Iowa, there's a listing of these opera houses. It's a little bit dated, which is part of why I want to talk to these gentlemen. The book was published in 1994, and a lot of the research is older than that. But I found out that there's an opera house in my town, and I'd always known that there was a defunct theater above the drugstore downtown, but I didn't know that it was the Steyer Opera House. So I contacted them.
And where is that?
In Decorah, Iowa.
In Decorah, okay.
Yeah, pardon me. And I just sort of went through the list and did a Google search for the houses that seemed to be, you know, not that torn down or no longer there. And some of the places that I contacted me back right away. And I was like, well, you know, I'll start this in the spring next year. This was late August, September of last year. And a couple of places called me back right away and were like, well, yeah, let's put on a show. Let's do it right now. And I'd been having conversations already, you know, while this process was going on, of finding out that there were these houses around.
So this wasn't a long-term passion of yours. You didn't grow up thinking about these beautiful old theaters.
No,
and
it was like an
part
accident.
Of it. This was just a sudden epiphany that, wow, these are really cool. But what made you want to perform in these spaces?
Well, as a singer-songwriter, as someone who was doing acoustic music, playing, and this was sort of a little bit an idea that was, it was partially formed before the show started to happen. It's the kind of thing that's become more true. What's happened, I think, over the course of this whole project is like a snowballing. There is a little bit of an idea, and then everyone sort of gloms onto it, and attention gets drawn to it, and you move forward. The idea of performing in a space that isn't a bar, where people are more interested or perhaps almost as interested in going to the bar and talking to their friends as they are in seeing what it is that you're doing as a performer, that's something that doesn't happen in a space that's designed where people sit in chairs and look at the stage. You know, you really sort of, you know, everyone kind of goes, what's going on? When somebody stands up and walks down the aisle, you have to interrupt the show, you know. It's as a performance space, a place like this just is over and above anything else you could get into as a songwriter, unless you have an audience that's only going to be there to pay attention to you. And if you're going to new places, it seems like it's sort of the best way to do it.
And as an acoustic performer, you have kind of a particular emphasis on performing in this kind of space because, of course, they're not electrified shows back when these were built.
They're pre-sound system spaces. They're what we have right now in all over the world is a world where you can click a button and you can have almost anything. If you got a credit card and a computer, you can have anything brought to your home instantly, overnight, whatever. What you can't get is sitting in a space that was designed to acoustically enwrap you in sound with a whole bunch of other people who have agreed that they want to sit there quietly and be a part of that experience. And it's, you know, it's an old idea, and it's a great thing. When people actually go to these spaces and have this experience, I think it's something that they're going to want to do over and over again. It's great.
The opera houses that you've been performing in so far, there are some that have been beautifully renovated out there. Are you performing only in the ones that have been renovated, or are you performing in some kind of dated Art Deco type spaces as well?
Well, I think they, because most of them are around 100 years old, all of the ones actually that we've played in are at least 100 years old. The youngest one was the theater in Toledo, the Weeding Theater in Toledo, which was built in 1912 and reopened its doors for the first time on the first week of February this year. I was in there on the 22nd to meet with them initially. I mean, they sort of need renovation and constant care. Something that's that old has been taken care of well, for even if it's not renovated. Like the one in Wachir is not renovated per se, but has definitely been kept up, you know, and things that are that old sort of need it. So yes, kind of all of the places that we have played have been recently renovated, but you know, that's sort of the name of the game when you have something that's that old.
Right. So you decided you wanted to start playing in these spaces, but now you're performing with a bunch of other people too. How did that happen?
Well, I don't have any draw. I'm not famous. I just sort of reached out to the first person I could think of who might be interested in that, being a part of something that was essentially to draw attention to the theaters, but also, you know, there sort of has to be something that deserves attention to draw attention to these theaters. And I called Dave Moore, who I've known since the first year I moved to Iowa City, which was in 1993. A friend of mine used to stay at his house when he lived in his summer cabin, and we played music there. And so I reached out to him, and I reached out to some other artists who did acoustic music, people that I had met through the Stone City General Store, which has a great open mic and sort of sit around pick-in party every Sunday all summer long. That's really, it's a very talented group of people. Everybody who I spoke to was like, that's a fantastic idea. And at a certain point I had to cut it off. Like, okay, these are the people who are going to be a part of this show. And then, you know, try to maintain it as that.
I've been looking at your Facebook page, and you've shared a lot of pictures of a lot of the places that you've performed. Can you give me a highlight? What has been your favorite?
What has been my favorite? I think my favorite, the show, at the end of the day, it seems like the show is really sort of the simple part. The building up to how the shows happen in the first place, the contacting the people who are in the communities, is what takes all of the time. And it's where the relationships develop. And that's sort of, it's turned into this kind of thing where I'm developing relationships with these people in these tiny little towns who operate theaters, some of whom are in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And they're fantastic people that have wonderful stories. And I am, that's what it is. The show is 2 hours, you know. There and weeks and weeks worth of conversations and haggling and making deals and associating with the town bank and the other businesses in the community so that they're okay with having posters hung and they understand what's going on. It's really it's mostly explanation what I do, and then the show itself is this sort of like thing that happens at the end. You're like, okay, thanks and good night.
This fall you have a bunch of shows planned. Things seem to be snowballing a little bit.
Yeah. And there are people who reached out immediately, and the attention that was garnered by those initial shows, people were like, wow, that was a fantastic idea. But as I said, we weren't really going to start until this spring. There were two shows last fall, the last day of September and the first day of October in Clermont and Coggin, Iowa. Clermont is just a beautiful, beautiful, original, outside of the fact that it now has a ramp for wheelchairs on the side, which is probably a good thing, especially if you need that. And the one in Coggin, which was renovated into a movie theater in the 30s, both of which were fantastic shows. But we decided when those shows happened so quickly that we would just use them to develop media to do promotion for the shows that were going to happen in the spring, this spring, this just past spring. And so we, not very many people went to those shows, but they were filmed and they were recorded. And the thing that the YouTube video that you see is still shots from those, and they're beautiful spaces. So it did really well. But as the thing goes along, more people pay attention to it. Media that was sort of interested in it is now more interested, not unlike yourself. And like, whoa, this Opera House thing. So it's been a lot of my time for a long time, and people like yourself and the Des Moines Register and other media outlets whose names you would know if I mentioned them have started reaching out to me, which is really sort of, it's fantastic. And it's made it more possible for us to take the show to other theaters in other small towns. And, you know, having that done, use the media in the local communities. What I do when I put a show on is I call all of the small town newspapers, the ones that have like a once a week, you know, Thursday evening paper, and make sure that it's in all of them. I don't really have an advertising budget, and I want people to understand that these theaters exist. So I, you know, it's a story rather than an advertisement. You know, I can't buy space,
right?
But I do. I get it. It's a good story.
Well, we are talking about the Iowa Opera House project. You can find a link on our Facebook page, and you can see all the upcoming dates, or some of the upcoming dates, on that as well. I'm talking with Sam Knutson, and here's his song, "The General Store." This is Talk of Iowa.
Grocery store's too big, and no one stops to pass the time. I can't get what I need to fix my rig, and there's a million kinds of shit that could be mine. Rolls and rolls of tiny, shiny things, it's true. But we don't need better things, we need better things to do.
You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about Iowa's opera houses and an effort to bring live music back to these beautiful venues. Sam Knutson is going to stick around with us here. He's a singer-songwriter from Iowa City and the originator of the Iowa Opera House Project. And now we're going to dig into the history of these opera houses. George D. Glenn and Richard Poole co-authored a book called The Opera Houses of Iowa, published back in the early 90s, and they're both with me now. Hello, George.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure, believe me.
And Richard, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for being here today.
Again, also my pleasure.
How did this idea of digging into the history of these opera houses for a book come about for you, George?
It began back with the Mid-America Theater Conference, which was a coalition of theater historians and theater educators from a seven-state area, including Iowa, who got the idea that maybe we ought to find out what was extant in terms of theater stuff. The theater is a little unique in that once the play is done, it's gone, and there's not... It's hard to do a history of something that disappears as you do it. So we're always looking for stuff that will help us understand what's happening. So that got us started, and Richard and I were co-hosts for Iowa, and we began thinking, well, maybe there might be maybe 25 or 30 old theaters around. And so we began sending out questionnaires. And we're somewhat astounded when we got 300 responses from around the state.
Wow.
We ultimately identified 300 extant opera houses and found evidence of about 700 more from the state. Now, we're talking about a period of development from about the end of the Civil War to the beginning of World War I. So it's not that extensive a period. And we're also talking about a variety of different types of structures. I think it's important to note that there are, perhaps artificially, classifications of opera houses.
Right. Well, and let's, you're talking about, you guys looked into 300 of them. Richard, do we have any idea how many so-called opera houses there were in Iowa, if 300 or so still remained?
Well, George mentioned the idea that there are still 700 names. What happened many times was that opera houses got taken over by someone else, renamed, expanded, enlarged. And so the same structure, perhaps modified at times, would have had different names, and it would have been listed as a different opera house. So virtually any town of pride or pretension, and we're not just talking about the big towns in Iowa, we're certainly not just talking about Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Sioux City, Council Bluffs. We're talking about Manson and Wetchear and Manning and Rodney. And virtually every town of pride and pretension had something they called an opera house. And it's important to remember that the reason they were called opera houses and also sometimes Academy of Music rather than theater is because theater still had a reputation of being not quite morally respectable. But at the same time, these small towns wanted the cachet of the excitement and the culture of a big city, and so they called them opera houses.
Except
in the big cities, very seldom was opera house playing.
Right.
But it made something really for a chamber of commerce thing as well to say, oh, look, we have an opera house in our town. It's very educational. It's very entertaining. And so this is why you should come here.
And it seems to me that these structures, and many of them are very ornate and beautiful, they would have been extremely expensive to put up. So what was in it for the town? It was a point of pride, but why invest that much money?
Well, it wasn't. The town didn't put them up. Most of the time they were commercial ventures. Somebody got the bright idea of I can make some money if I have if I put an opera house in on the third story of my clothing store building. As in the case in Decorah, if Steyer, who owned a brewery and a tavern, put an opera house in the third story of his tavern.
They used to also, they would sell shares.
Yeah.
I have in my collection, I think George might have some, 2 shares in the town where you'd pay someone $10 a share and you'd own a portion of the opera house. And the idea of, again, owning the building itself was called an opera house block, but it was really just the building. On the bottom floor, you would have the store, You would rent out rooms. You'd have a stationery store. You'd have a post office. But then on the second or third floor, you'd have the opera house. And the person who owned the building and really put up the money was the one who would go ahead and book the acts. And there were always plenty of acts ready to be booked coming out of the larger cities. And remember, too, between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the 20th century, track mileage just exploded. So you could get to anywhere from anywhere on the train. And so there are plenty of people who wanted to make a living doing theater in rural and small town areas, and Iowa was just filled with that. And it wasn't just Iowa, too. It was the Dakotas. It was Minnesota. All the places in the Midwest really had, again, some opera houses. Some were, again, points of pride. Some were very ornate. Some were very simple. Some sat as much as 2,000 people. Some would seat 150. But remember, these are all-purpose spaces. Even the big ones were all-purpose spaces. And many times they were the largest physical space in a town. So if you wanted to have a revival meeting sometimes, if you wanted to have any other kind of church service, if you wanted to have a high school graduation. In fact, in some of the towns we found that what used to be the opera house structure, they'd clear out all the seats, and they'd have it would be stage faced. They would have a stage at one end. They'd put up nets and play basketball. And even I can remember my high school days in our quote unquote gym. There was a stage at one end of the gym. So that idea continued itself well into the 20th century.
Well, and you've already made it clear that these opera houses were not built to put on operas for the most part. But let's talk about some of the kinds of performances that would have taken place in these spaces.
Yeah, well, never opera, as far as I know. Maybe in some of the huge grand opera houses in the major metropolitan areas, maybe in Dubuque or in Sioux City. They ever play opera in Sioux City, Richard?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. But almost everything else you can think of, farce and melodrama and mystery and religious plays and on and on and on. Everything,
sure.
Everything that we find on television today, you could find in the opera houses back in the turn of the last century.
Were these places big enough to draw vaudeville acts?
Oh, you bet.
Sure.
Yeah. And even in a place like Sioux City, I'm sure Dubuque, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, they had specific houses. I know in Sioux City between 1900 and 1920, there were repertory houses. There was a company in Sioux City that played in the Princess Theater for about 10 years or so. There was a vaudeville house. There were burlesque houses. And burlesque, of course, back in those days was, you know, incredibly tame compared to the kind of things you see now.
Well, yeah, there was a difference between burlesque and burlicue. Yeah, burlesque was farcical as much as anything else.
I've also read about panoramas traveling around, giant paintings that would be unrolled slowly so the audience could see them. Is that something that would have been shown in these spaces?
It would depend upon the size of the space. Now, the panoramas go back to the first part of the, I think even earlier than the 19th century, where they had them back east. For example, in the PV Grand Opera House in Sioux City, when you talk about what the theater could accommodate, this was on a theatrical circuit. And what happened is the shows would come and play in various places in the United States, and then in Des Moines, and then in Sioux City. But what happened once, there was a theater in Minneapolis that burned out, and there was a water show. That is to say, they had kayaking in the stage. So what happened in Sioux City was they cut the stage out, put a liner in it, filled it with water, and had a water show.
Wow.
And as George will attest, one of the big shows for the big theaters was Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
And they had real horses. They would have this roller that would be underneath the stage. There would be guys operating the roller and throwing up dust and clothes and everything. And the horses would ride on this treadmill going full gallop, going from one side of the stage to the other as the treadmill moved. Now, of course, if something happened, the people on the other end would get run into by the horses. But that was always a very big deal.
When you set out to research the opera houses, probably many of the ones that you looked into had not been restored or maybe were updated in the 1950s or something like that when they were turned into a movie theater. Now, many opera houses around the state are being lovingly restored to their original condition. How do you feel about this movement?
Nothing but praise.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's great that people have enough pride and pretension in their community to say, look, this is part of our community. This is a wonderful, not just entertainment facility, but it's really part of us. Because we're saying to the county that they happen to be in, as well as the state of Iowa, look, this is not just backwoods kind of stuff. We really have something that is really classy, and we have something that people can take pride in. And, of course, you know, I can just speak for, I know George will talk about the restoration in Cedar Falls. When the Sioux City Orpheum, for example, which was built, this one that's up now, it's the third one in the line of Orpheums that was here in Sioux City, was built in 27. I mean, it was a multi-million-dollar restoration, and it really is a jewel. It's the leading character in its own play. If you ever get to Sioux City, come in and see this place. There are Orpheums all over the United States, and I know I'm a son of Sioux City, so I am positively inclined. But it is gorgeous. It's breathtaking. And, of course, it brings in all sorts of shows, and it's a really point of pride for the city.
Well, what kinds of shows do come into the Orpheum now?
In Sioux City?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Orpheum was a circuit that started in the 19th century out in San Francisco, and then there are many Orpheums that were built throughout the United States. Omaha has one. There's one in Kansas City. There's a whole circuit of them. So what you do is you get, for example, we have the Sioux City Symphony that plays in the Orpheum. We have singing acts that come in. We have a Broadway series that comes in, and you can still, if you want to. One of my students is getting married on the stage of the Orpheum. So it can be used, again, it's a multi-purpose facility. I know my university, Radcliffe University, graduates its students on the stage of the Orpheum, and it really is quite spectacular because you've got about 2,600 seats. It's a vertical space, and it really is lovely.
Well, I want to bring Sam Knutson back into the conversation here. He's been sitting here patiently listening, and as he mentioned in the first segment of the show, and he is the originator of the Iowa Opera House Project, an effort to bring live acoustic music back to these opera houses all over the state. And he dug into your book, so he was excited to hear that you were going to be on the show. And Sam, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Well, it's fantastic to meet you guys after having, you know, read work that you put together and looked at a bunch of things that you've looked at.
Thank you.
We were so excited to see that article in the paper a while back that you were going to, you're doing this thing.
Right.
Yeah.
This guy's
good. Because when George and I started out, there was almost nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we were kind of voices in the wilderness. You know, I can remember giving papers at conferences, and George can probably back me up with this, and I would talk about opera houses, and people would go,
It's just by luck that I started to get into it at a time when a lot of renovation was going on. And just, you know, I happened to be curious at the right time, and a whole bunch of things snowballed. But last weekend we played at the Opera House in Blairsburg, which I believe was probably not functional. Well, I know it wasn't functional when you guys were putting your book together. The two weekends before that, we were at the Opera House in Ainsworth, which was gutted when you guys looked at it. The King Theater in Albia. We were in the King Theater in Albia the night before that. The Weeding in Toledo. We're about to play the E.E. Warren Opera House in Greenfield, which reopened its doors.
And, the Weeding has been restored.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
The E.E. Warren in Greenfield, which is fantastic. It looks like a castle.
Yeah.
With the bottom is kind of a storefront. The opera house is upstairs, but it does look like a castle.
Yeah, the Warren family lived in an apartment in the front part that had the turret, like that was part of their home. And then the back part of the second story and third story of the building, were the Opera House, and it was built on top of a store.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And that show's coming up on July 28th.
That's July 28th, yeah.
And then you're going to be in Elkader after that?
Then we're going to be in Elkader on August 12th. That's going to be recorded for rebroadcast by Iowa Public Radio. And then we're going to be at the Grand in Dubuque. Around Christmas time, we're going to be at the Corning Opera House, which was, I believe, also closed when you guys looked at it.
Yeah, the Corning Opera House was in my territory. George took 35,
yeah.
Iowa 35 East, and I took West. And
oh,
I can
wow.
remember standing in the balcony, which had almost been gutted,
yeah.
trying not to fall through the holes,
right.
taking pictures of the stage.
Yeah. Supposedly sometime next month they're going to reopen the doors of the Volga Opera House where I was. That's right by Elkader.
Oh, yeah, neat.
Yeah, it was mostly open again and then got flooded in 2008.
Ah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. But somebody bought it from the town for a dollar who was sort of interested in having country music in his truck rally in the grounds surrounding it. And it's, you know, towns where there are less than a couple of thousand people and probably have been about the same size, having an opera house like this is just, I mean, it seems like that's where they remain unchanged. Like, still says opera house the way that it did on the front.
Sure.
And, well, George and Richard, it sounds like Sam's giving you guys a reason to hit the road again.
How fun. Let me just mention this. We had so much fun. And, you know, I've known George now 30 years or more. And it was, and one of the best things that happened was that we, you know, we had an opportunity to meet each other and to work with each other.
Yeah.
And it was really great to work with George, and it was also just fun.
Yeah,
to go ahead and go around and do all this research.
Yeah, it is fun.
Well, George and Richard, I want you guys to stay on the line. They're co-authors of a book called The Opera Houses of Iowa, which was published back in the early 90s. And Sam Knutson, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It was my pleasure. Good to meet you guys.
Sam, yeah,
good to meet you, Sam.
Sam Knutson is the originator of the Iowa Opera House Project. Again, you can find a link on our Facebook page and on their Facebook page. They have all kinds of pictures of the events that they've already done and information about upcoming events as well. Sam, thanks a lot. Coming up in just a moment, we're also going to talk about the opera houses in Pella and in Greenfield. You're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can give us a call and tell us about the Opera House in your town, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the Opera Houses of Iowa. We've been talking about the Iowa Opera House Project, an effort to bring live music back into these spaces. And we've also been talking about the history of opera houses in Iowa. George Glenn and Richard Poole are here with me. They co-authored a book called The Opera Houses of Iowa that was published back in 1994. And Richard, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City, and Sioux City is where you live. How much of a difference do you think the renovation of the Orpheum has made to downtown Sioux City? Oh, I'm sorry. There, now I can hear you. How much of a difference do you think the Orpheum has made to downtown Sioux City?
Really significant, because it's really the anchor, the jewel of downtown Sioux City. You know, it was originally built in 27, and then it went dark. It was twinned into movie houses, and then finally in 1999, it was remodeled with Ray Shepherdson, who was with an architectural firm out of Cleveland, and he specializes in revamping historic opera houses, and it makes all the difference. I mean, when you go downtown and see the Orpheum sign, wow. And, of course, what it does is it brings people in from various communities outside of Sioux City. So it's not just for the city itself, but it's for the county as well, for Woodbury County.
And, George, yep. You live in Cedar Falls, right?
Yes.
And, of course, for people in Cedar Falls, they're familiar with the Oster Regent Theater. When I was growing up in Cedar Falls, that was a movie theater. That's where I saw Tootsie and Dances with Wolves. And as I got older, it became an art theater. And then it got taken over to be renovated. What has changed for downtown Cedar Falls because of the Oster Regent Theater, which is now just stunningly beautiful?
Well, it's all part of a process, I think, for Cedar Falls. And I'm not sure whether the changeover or change back, I guess, of the Oster Regent into a legitimate theater from being a movie theater was the trigger, but it certainly was part of a process, the Main Street process, to bring people back to Main Street. And I think it helps, because if you're what really happened was the people who owned the theater basically gave it to the Cedar Falls Community Theater, which was looking for a home. They had been playing in a junior high school auditorium. And then in that process, there was a fundraising process, and some serious money was donated to the theater, and it was renovated out of its movie theater mode back to a theatrical mode. It couldn't go all the way back to its original configuration because there had been some serious exterior deterioration, walls that needed to be replaced, et cetera. But it's a wonderful space to play. It seats about 350 people. And it's serving the function of an opera house, because not only does the community theater perform there, a number of high schools in the area bring their productions in and perform them there. We bring in bands, we bring in musical acts, we bring in comedians. It's got to keep the place going and got to keep paying the bills. And I think that's one of the problems that any place like, well, I don't know about the Orpheum, but I know they probably have as many problems paying bills as the theater here does. When you're dealing with a 100-year-old building, things wear out, you know. But the difference between when community theater started and now, in terms of Main Street, there is hardly a vacant building on Main Street now in Cedar Falls. And whether the Auster Region can take credit for that or not, I don't know, but might as well.
Right. Well, it's certainly part of the movement, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, George, Glenn, and Richard Poole, thank you both so much for talking with me today.
Oh,
thank you.
George, Glenn, and Richard Poole co-authored a book called The Opera Houses of Iowa, published back in 1994. And now we're going to take a little bit of a look around the state. And with me next is Kevin McQuaid. He's executive director of the Pella Opera House. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be here.
When was the Pella Opera House built?
It was built in 1900, so it's 112 years old.
And what happened to it as time went on? I mean, it has been renovated now, but tell me about the different iterations of this space over time.
I'd be happy to do so. And before I respond in detail, it was great that you had George and Richard on your show. We have a copy of their book on display in the lobby, and we use it continually, so it's wonderful that you had them on. So the Opera House was built in 1900, and then it operated as an opera house. There's some disagreement until 1917 or 1918, and then it was sold. And for the next approximately 70 years, until the mid-80s, it had a lot of different lives. It was, at various times, an automobile repair garage. It was a roller rink. It was a bowling alley. It was a department and/or appliance store. So its
life as a theater was very short.
It was very short, and you know we're not really sure exactly why it closed as an opera house. It may have been due to things that were going on with World War I, and perhaps business was not as strong as it could have been. But in any case, you're right, had a short first life.
So when did you start thinking about renovating this space?
Well, I can't take credit for thinking about it because I arrived in my position in January, so I'm still relatively
new. Okay, so when did people start thinking about renovating this space?
I didn't want to take credit for the great work of the people that were responsible. But they in the mid-'80s, there was a group of concerned citizens in town who were well aware of the opera house's history. Their families had been here for generations, and they all agreed that it was a shame that the opera house was no longer functioning as one. And you can imagine, after so many businesses being in a space and renovating each time to suit the needs of their business, that the opera house was not in great shape. And so they decided to put a fundraising committee together, and they did gangbusters. They raised approximately $2 million in a six-week time period. So there was just tremendous enthusiasm and support in the community for recapturing the original spirit and look and feel of the Opera House, and they made it happen. And in 1990, they reopened, and we've been functioning as an Opera House ever since.
With all of the different iterations of the building that was the Opera House, was there anything left of the original Opera House?
Fortunately, well, there's a plus and a downside to this. The downside was we didn't have many pictures at all of the interior space and all of its different lives, and we had no pictures of all at all of the original Opera House. So it was difficult in the beginning to remember or recall what it was like. Fortunately, there were some people living in Pella at the time who could recall having attended Opera House's performances in the early 1900s, and they conducted interviews with those people, and we were able to get sketches from some of them of what the space looked like then. And in the upper reaches of the building, at the very top and the back, there were portions of the wall that had not been painted or wallpapered over, so we were not only able to recreate the original template for the stenciling pattern. We were able to trace that because it still existed. But we were also able to get paint samples of the original colors so that we could have those analyzed and recreate the original pigmentation of the colors of the interior. So,
wow.
So it looks the way it used to look.
And what is it used for now?
It was so funny when you were asking one of the authors. I think George was speaking about Sioux City, and he was just talking about all of the things that go on at the Opera House there. And the same things happen here. It's a wide variety of things. We have rock and roll bands come in here. We have live theater come in here. We have dance come in here. We do a film series where it's audience participation along with the classics, where people are encouraged to sing along with the films. We have guest lectures in here. We're having a documentary about bullying here as a service, as an outreach to the schools. So on any given night, there's something really rich and varied going on there, and almost anything can happen here on stage that has something to do with the fine and performing arts.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for telling us about it.
My pleasure.
Kevin McQuaid is the executive director of the Pella Opera House. And in just a second, we're going to check in with the Warren Cultural Center in Greenfield, Iowa. But Bill is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to throw in the comment that many opera house stage curtains are being restored, and the largest collection of restored opera house stage curtains in America is based in Mount Pleasant at the Theater Museum on the old Threshers complex. And anyone can go there and make arrangements to see a beautiful collection of wonderful opera house stage curtains. The other thing that we've discovered in recent years, some country schools had nice opera house stage curtains with local advertisers, messages around a piece of artwork. Perhaps the three most spectacular examples of country school stage curtains that I've seen are at Miles, and at the Boland School up in Worth County, and then a recent stage curtain was discovered in the Mackey School in Boone. And from what I can tell, there are about 10 country schools in Iowa that do have nice opera house stage curtains.
Well, Bill, I'm so glad you called to tell us about that. Sounds like another show for us entirely. It's always great to hear from you, Bill. And we've got one more guest to squeeze in here. Ken Seide is the executive director of the Warren Cultural Center in Greenfield, Iowa. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Tell me about the Warren Cultural Center.
Well, the Warren Opera House here in Greenfield was built in 1896, and it's very much the epitome of what's been described earlier in your show. There was a retail space at the sidewalk level, and then the second floor contained office space and the residence of the Warrens. And the majority of the second floor then was given over to the Opera House Auditorium. And its stage, there was also a third level that contained a couple of other residence rooms and a balcony for the theater. The retail level has been in really continuous use almost since it was built as a dry goods store originally by the Warrens and then a dress shop and a furniture store. It didn't have quite the turnover that some of the other places did. The upstairs, the auditorium, really had its heyday as a performance venue around the turn of the century and into the early 19-teens. But we can tell from newspaper accounts by the 20s, it was being used as a movie theater. A local movie house opened here in town, so that was the end of movies here. And by the early 30s, we can't find any records of any live performances being staged here. It was used for some ceremonies, some gatherings, graduations. Someone mentioned earlier playing basketball. That was the case up here as well. And by the early 1950s, the auditorium was in complete disuse and became home to pigeons, and it, for all purposes, was a derelict building.
Wow. When did the renovation efforts begin?
Well, they began in earnest about the mid-1990s. As far back as, say, 1979, my father, who was the newspaper editor here for many years, wrote an editorial calling on the town to do something to restore the Warren Opera House. But nothing really happened at that point. But in the mid-90s, a local citizen purchased the building and gifted it to the local Main Street Greenfield organization. And that really began the work to restore it. They did some studies for feasibility to see if the shell of the building was sound enough, and it was. And so they went forward doing some of the mundane projects like foundation work, roof repair, tuck pointing. About five years ago, we got a real boost in our efforts to restore the place through a variety of grants that came available all at about the same time. So in about that time, we were able to expand the project from just the Warren building to purchase the neighboring two buildings and expand our vision to become the Warren Cultural Center. It opened up some great opportunities architecturally. With those other two buildings, we could maintain more of the integrity of the Opera House. We were able to move an elevator out of the Opera House building and into the building next door, so that opened up the auditorium space again. And like it's been described at Pella, we had historic preservationists who came in and were able to determine the original stenciling patterns, the colors, the woodwork, the floors have all been brought back to the original of what they were in 1896.
Wow, that is remarkable. And what is the space used for mostly now?
It's a multi-purpose space. We've just been open about 3 months now, but in the first 4 weeks that we were open, we held a banquet to celebrate our grand reopening. We had a jazz group played in there. And actually, it comes to mind that we had a young woman who graduated from Greenfield who sang some operatic numbers on our stage. So
a little bit of opera in the Opera House.
We did actually have some here. But we've had a Beatles tribute band. The high school students had their prom dance up here. We've had some wedding receptions, some graduation receptions, and meetings up here. So we're trying to book a variety of performers to come in over the next several months, from marionettes to Japanese taiko drummers, just to get the place used again.
Well, and the Iowa Opera House project is coming your way, right?
Yes, it is. We're very much looking forward to having them here. I've heard them perform, and it's great music, and I hope we have a full house for them here.
Well, Ken, I wish you much success with your newly renovated opera house.
Thank you very much.
Ken Seide is the executive director of the Warren Cultural Center in Greenfield, Iowa. And again, if you want to find out more about these opera houses and the Iowa Opera House Project, there's a link on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we continue our series on Iowa towns and cities with how towns are transformed by disasters. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.